Less than 3 weeks, President Trump had been scheduled to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore, but maybe not. The president said yesterday that meeting might be delayed. Retired Air Force General Dan Leaf believes whether or not that meeting takes place as scheduled is less important than continuing to work on the relationship between the two countries. Leaf is a former deputy commander of U.S. Pacific Command here in Hawaii and was later director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. He tells HPR News Director Bill Dorman he's still encouraged by the broader discussion that's underway about the future of the Korean Peninsula.
It's a time of great opportunity. But in the past week or so, we've seen sort of a reversion by both sides to the stances that haven't produced progress over decades. And that concerns me, but maybe it's part of the posturing to get to the summit.
And the South Korean president now in the United States, what, if anything, is there for South Korea to do at this point to help or be involved with this process?
Well, I think they've been very helpful. I think the South Korean government has been careful about what it's said in both conversations with the U.S. and North Korea. Some in South Korea would say too helpful towards North Korea, but it has moved the process forward. I think that what the South Korean government and the U.S. government have to do is not necessarily be of completely like-mindedness, but avoid direct contradictions or inconsistencies, and maintain the focus on the ultimate goal of denuclearization without ruling out progress in other areas.
When we last spoke, you talked about the importance of the U.S.-South Korean military exercises to go ahead as planned, and they did by and large, but there was an exercise involving U.S. B-52 bombers that South Korea declined, pulled back from, basically. How significant is that, do you feel?
It is significant in the regard that North Korea said they understood the need for such exercises, and then they didn't, which is a pattern we've seen before. I think both sides have to remain, both the U.S. and the Republic of Korea, South Korea, need to retain some degree of flexibility and not let a perturbation like that totally disrupt the potential for real progress in Korea.
While denuclearization of North Korea remains a goal, you've spoken about the importance of reconciliation between the United States and North Korea. Why is that such an important factor in your mind?
Well, I think history tells us that reconciliation is a key element to resolution of any conflict. And without it, progress in other areas is likely to be temporary, if it happens at all. South Korea and North Korea have worked at reconciliation. It has progressed very slowly and in fits and starts, but through joint business endeavors, family reunions, the Sunshine Policy, there have been attempts. There's been no attempt, as far as I can tell, at real U.S. DPRK reconciliation. And we're good at reconciliation. We reconciled with Great Britain after the revolution and the War of 1812, with Germany and Japan, and most directly relevant with Vietnam post-war. We have to do it with North Korea. We have to reach an understanding and humanize each side, understand the perspectives. We may never agree, but if you don't build a relationship that gets past the past, the future will remain in doubt.
You know, you talk about reconciliation with Vietnam and the starting point there of an affinity between the Americans and the Vietnamese and in Vietnam, a fascination with many things American at the time when Vietnam was under a U.S. trade embargo, for example. North Korea, very different situation, very different starting point, and also arguably that's not a glamorous process. And the president seems to like the bright, shiny objects a little bit. How do you feel in terms of, again, that as part of that reconciliation picture?
I'm sure I agree with you that reconciliation with the DPRK would be much more complicated and difficult than with Vietnam, and that it will be impossible if we connect it to those bright and shiny objects, denuclearization, armistice, territorial disputes, human rights, et cetera. It should be a separate non-government process to begin with, known as Track 2. But we still have to do it. We have to understand the North Korean perspective, and they have to understand our perspective. And both sides need an appreciation on the importance of the process of reconciliation. And if we do that and reach an understanding on that, then we can start decades of hard work to get to a real relationship. And if, again, if we don't do it, then the value of any other agreements is going to be vastly reduced.
Closer to home right now in terms of Hawaii, the U.S. Missile Defense Agency has identified now 46 possible sites in Hawaii for missile radar. What do you make of that? What is important for people to understand about that?
Well, I think that the commander or the director of Missile Defense Agency, Lieutenant General Sam Greaves, said it clearly when he talked about the gaps in coverage that have to be filled by this and other radars. Those gaps don't go away. Let's fantasize that the summit leads to an instant solution with North Korea. There are other threats out there, and the gaps remain, and they're not just ballistic missiles. They could be cruise missiles, especially hypersonic. So it's a necessity in the long term. But with regard to North Korea, even if the summit is delayed a week, a month, a year, and the outcomes take time to be implemented, you could say that 2023 estimated year for operationalization of this radar makes it irrelevant to North Korea or the North Korea problem. And I disagree. Continuing to advance our capability has to be part of the maximum pressure policy. And in addition to being willing to work with North Korea to denuclearize and to solve other problems, we have to maintain a capability that makes it too difficult for them to become aggressive, more aggressive and adventurous.
You know, you mentioned other potential threats. China and Russia and hypersonic missiles are frequently mentioned in that context. But more generally, having spent so much time at Pacific Command, are you concerned at all in terms of a focus on North Korea to the potential exclusion of other issues? And I'm not talking from the military side, but perhaps the diplomatic side, that the apparatus of government, which seems to be focused on North Korea right now.
No, I'm not, because I've seen how that works. The role of Pacific Command, you said not just about the military, but there's a great deal of interaction with the State Department, with other governments and other militaries, and it's the headline gathering issue right now, but I guarantee up at Camp Smith, the great men and women of Pacific Command are working on all of these problems all the time, all the challenges, and they have the capacity to do that.
I have no doubt on that, but I wonder more about State Department levels and counterparts and hollowing out regionally within the Asia Pacific.
I'd be a bit concerned about the effect of early staffing reductions and some of the loss of expertise at the Department of State. But Secretary Pompeo, I think, has sort of turned in the other direction. And it will be a requirement that makes itself obvious to any government, any president, when they need to do the business of international relations. So I'm not particularly tensed up about that.
When you step back and give the big picture perspective now in terms of Asia Pacific, the United States, including Korea, but not limited to that, what might concern you?
Well, first of all, what encourages me is the potential for real progress on peace in Korea. What concerns me most right now is the increased friction with China regarding Taiwan. And I saw this when I was in Beijing last August. I had a sense that the Chinese were going to make Taiwan's status more of an issue. I think it is a fight they are choosing, and by fight I mean more of an argument than a battle. And if they become increasingly aggressive on it, we should be very concerned. We went through a fairly long period of relatively low tensions in the Taiwan Strait when Ma Ying-jeou was the president in Taiwan, and there were numerous joint agreements and some real progress at lowering the potential for conflict. And that's been largely reduced, and we should be concerned about that.
General, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Bill. Great to see you.
Lieutenant General Dan Leaf is a former deputy commander of U.S. Pacific Command here in Hawaii, retired, now executive director for Indo-Asia Pacific Operations at Cyberspace Operations Consulting.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we learn how the military prepares for hurricane season. But first, your quiz. How many counties are there in the state of Hawaii? No, that's not today's quiz question. You will have to work a little bit harder. So how many counties are there? Well, you might be tempted to say four. We always hear about the counties of Kauai, Maui, Hawaii, and then there's the city and county of Honolulu. But there's actually a fifth county that flies a little more under the radar. Kalawa County is located on Molokai's isolated Kalaupapa Peninsula. And according to National Geographic, Kalawao is the smallest and least populated county in the entire United States. The town of Kalaupapa is the county's only settlement and was used for over 100 years to exile patients suffering from Hansen's disease, also known as leprosy. The town's location was selected by the Hawaii Board of Health in 1866 after King Kamehameha V approved the act to prevent the spread of leprosy. But Kalawao County has no independent government of its own. So our question for you today is, who serves as the mayor of Kalawao County? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Benny Rietveld from Honolulu, Hawaii, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The National Weather Service is predicting an above-average hurricane season with 3 to 6 storms. And the military often responds in the event of a natural disaster in our community. But how does it prepare its troops and their families to ensure it can fulfill its defense mission? Joining me this morning is Mike Smith, who's the Director for Emergency Preparedness Training for the Navy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is very timely since NOAA just issued this report.
It sure is. It's great timing for us to discuss this and talk about being prepared, and both for the military and for everybody out in the community.
And share with us, because defense is your primary mission.
It sure is. Regardless of what happens in the state, any type of natural disaster, we've got to be ready to deploy ships or aircraft to whatever is needed around the world. So we've got that responsibility. And in order to accomplish that responsibility, we've got to be able to take care of the sailors, the airmen, the civilians, and all their family members. And at the same time, we've got to be able to help the state recover from any type of natural disaster.
Right. And many of the bases are along the coast. And so you've got that additional hazard of run-up. You know, you're in the inundation zone.
That's correct. We look at Pearl Harbor. We're right on the water, and much of the base and the adjoining flight line is right on the water. Over on Kauai, we've got the Pacific Missile Range Facility, and again, that's right on the beach. So any type of natural disaster, a storm, the storm surge that would be impacting the bases can really cause a lot of havoc.
And I grew up on an island in Guam, and there are military bases there, and we used to always kind of take our cues because we had typhoon conditions over there. And as soon as it got to a certain level and we saw the military ships and subs leaving, we knew this was serious stuff.
Sure is. We'll keep our submarines and our ships and the aircraft. They'll stay on the island as long as possible. But once we're sure that the storm is going to hit and there's going to be severe damage, we've got to get the ships out of the port and the airplanes to a safe haven.
And the concern there is, too, yeah, you've got to have time to prepare yourself, prepare your belongings if you're in an area that is that could be threatened. So you do want to take the steps to prepare before it actually hits.
Right. What we tell people is stay informed. And radio is a perfect place to get that information. Make a plan. It's great to rely on other people, but everybody needs to have a plan of what they're going to do, where they're going to go, what they're going to take with them, and have a kit. And that's basically what we try to tell people and really push for everybody to do that.
Right. And you could have situations for military families where the spouse is deployed somewhere and the family that's remaining with the children then really need to be aware because they may not be from here. This may be their first post or they're unfamiliar with how the storms happen out here in this region.
Right. And we're kind of fortunate where we're located because we can see a storm forming in the Pacific somewhere, and we've got a lot of time leading up to it. But you're right. We have a lot of young families, people that this may be their first duty station. The spouse is deployed. They're with young children, a number of different situations. So we have a big obligation to help them out as well.
And I imagine, though, the basics are the same for whether you're a civilian family or a military family.
It is. It's the same thing. I think right now the state is recommending that people have 14 days worth of food on hand. And you have to wonder how many people really do that. For the longest time, I didn't do that. And once I got into this position, I said, you know what? I need to start doing this too. And now we've done that. We've got food set aside. We've got water set aside. And we're prepared. We've made that plan, and we have our kit.
And you grew up on an island too.
I did. I grew up on the East Coast, and the East Coast gets a lot of hurricanes. And they would come up. And growing up as a young boy, we're never really prepared. We didn't have as much preparedness, as much knowledge maybe then as we do now. The systems now for tracking and detecting storms are so much better. But still, we've got to be ready.
Right. And I know officials always advise to have a go bag ready.
Absolutely. In my own home, I've got food that I keep in the garage. I bought some of that food online. You can buy it. It comes in a box, and it's I think, 30 days of supplies of food. It's that dried food.
Dehydrated.
Yeah. It's not delicious.
Okay.
But it'll serve in an emergency. And our plan is that we would use what's in the refrigerator first, use that up. We've got the grill outside so we can cook food if we have to. And then if something happens and we can't get more food, we've got the 30-day supply. But I also have a separate kit that if something happened and we had to leave our home, we've got things in there.
Right. And if you're staying put, I know if you lose power and you lose your refrigerator and your freezer, generally the thought is, well, you're going to eat well for the next few days, barbecue all your steaks and your meats and all of that. But then after that, then you have to change your diet. You eat canned food.
You will.
Whatever's available.
You'll get to that point, right. And, you know, I think back to Iñiki, was that 92 when Iñiki came through? I wasn't here at the time, but they said up to 4 weeks after the hurricane went through, 20% of Kauai still didn't have power. So, yeah, we could lose power and be subjected to eating some things that we really wouldn't normally want to have.
Right, and I've mentioned this before, and I've been without power for, I believe it was 3 months, and without water for 1 month. So you really have to be resilient, and you have to learn how to take care of your family, and then hopefully you'll get some other assistance. But it's all about being prepared. And I know you have your go bag with you. talk about some of the items that are important for folks to have.
Well, some of the things that you want to have in your go bag is naturally food and water. And I mentioned that the state is recommending 14 days. I don't have that in my go bag, but I have that at other places. This is just for a couple of days if we had to go to a shelter. But the things that we might not want to don't think about might be like medicine. So I keep a couple of extra days worth of supply of different types of medicine, dog food. I've got two puppies,
right,
and they're going to want to eat too. So some shelters allow, some don't allow. So you got to make a plan for what you're going to do with the pets and have food set aside for them.
Right. And the reality is we're seeing families on the Big Island deal with, an abrupt evacuation,
right,
and they've had to deal with all their pets and, just getting out at moment's notice.
And that's what happens a lot of times when we have to evacuate. It's at a moment's notice. So that's goes back to that being informed and having a plan. If you had to evacuate tomorrow or in 6 hours, do you have things set aside?
Right. And so you folks are going to be, conducting some drills?
We are. We do this every year. We conduct a preparedness drill, and we go through an actual week of exercises leading up to a landfall of a major storm. So that gives us about 5 days of different steps that we take, and as the storm progresses and gets closer and closer, we do more things. And eventually we would get to the point where we would say, okay, now the ships and the airplanes have to deploy. We won't actually deploy the ships, but we'll go through all the process that it takes to get all the ships out.
Right. The idea is training. You drill it, and then when it actually happens to trigger it, then you know what to do.
Right. And then we could go into a recovery phase of our exercise, and we would simulate that there was some damage and what we would do to help our families recover from that, help the ships come back to the port, and it may even be helping the state. We've exercised where we've used Pearl Harbor as an alternate port if something were to happen to Honolulu port and container ships couldn't get in. And so much of our goods come by container ships. But if something were to happen to the port, the cranes were destroyed, the port was blocked, then we can use Pearl Harbor.
Okay, so those are just that's Plan B.
It's the alternate.
Right.
We don't have the capability that they have in Honolulu, but we could offload barges.
Okay, just to be able to keep the flow of goods, of food, that the essentials coming
through.
All those
emergency essential items.
Right, okay. So, good. Good start to the season. Got everybody's attention. The prediction is, 3 to 6 storms, and it runs from June 1st.
Through the end of November.
November. Okay, so you got to keep on your toes.
Yes, we do.
All right. Well, Mike Smith, thanks for joining us this morning. And as May marks Military Appreciation Month, a big mahalo for all that the military does.
Thank you, and thanks to the radio for helping us out.
All right. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
I'm Elizabeth Mattis Namgyel, author of The Logic of Faith. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be speaking about finding certainty beyond belief and doubt.
Sunday morning at 11.
Officials are assuring that Puna Geothermal Venture has done everything it can to minimize the threat of lava on its pressurized wells. That's the subject of today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat, featuring reporter Brittany Light. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
So tell us, we understand that they believe that they've minimized that threat and they've quench the wells.
Yes. So officials yesterday made a big push to communicate to the public that things are as safe as they could possibly be at this moment. I think there was a little bit of a lack of information. People were not really hearing from officials what was going on with the lava that was creeping toward the plant. And so a little bit of hysteria was starting to break out. But yesterday, officials came together and said that they have done what they can to make the plant as safe as possible, considering what's going on.
Yeah, I think someone might have said that things were a little overblown. But it's hard,
yeah.
You know. I know when you look at those aerial pictures and you see the lava that's right up against the facility, you're kind of wondering, you know, well, what could happen?
It's hard to say. You know, the head of Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, you know, in one breath he said everything is stable, predictable. And in another breath he said, but there are many unpredictable things that could happen. I think the real issue here is that there are very few, if any, geothermal power plants like this located so close to such an active lava source. I don't think any other facility has ever experienced lava flowing over it. So there are a lot of unknowns.
Right. And I understand that they did reach out to other locales. I think New Zealand, they've got a geothermal facility down there and other places where they're trying to harness that energy.
Yes, they also reached out to a power plant in Iceland, and they said, we've never experienced this before. So what could happen if the lava does run over these wells? It has never been tested out before. Hopefully we don't become the guinea pig for that experiment. But I think what officials are trying to say is that they think everything will be okay. They think that the public is in a safe spot in terms of the lava going toward the plant. Nobody needs to evacuate at this time, but there are lots of unknowns.
Right, and there is a lot of sulfur dioxide in the air. I think in your article you mentioned that the workers had some difficulty doing what they needed to do because of that threat.
Yeah, the volcano itself is emitting 15,000 tons of sulfur dioxide per day right now, which is more than has been recorded in any recent history anyway. But of course, the issue at the plant is that these wells could release even more of this gas. And how much, we're not sure. But if that were to happen, which is the worst case scenario, it could be so much sulfur dioxide that it would be a huge health concern. Sulfur dioxide has a really sharp, pungent smell, and it can be deadly if it's inhaled in substantial quantities.
Right. So if folks choose to stay down in that area, they just need to be aware that if something happens, they need to move out of there quickly.
Right. So as of now, officials are saying there's no need to evacuate due to the lava being on the plant property, but they are closely monitoring that.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Brittany. We appreciate your coverage.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. And to read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm Cedric Amanaka, former host of Aloha Shorts. We're celebrating Bamboo Ridge's new book, The Best of Aloha Shorts, by bringing the team back together for a single live performance on August 11th. It'll be poems and stories read by talented actors, tunes from House Band Hamajang, and I'll be back at the mic too. Join us at the Palaku Theater for The Best of Aloha Shorts Live. Reservations at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored by Le Jardin Academy.
Aloha Shorts, yes. Well, our contributing political analyst Neil Milner joins us for today's Long View. Do you have your Aloha Shorts on today?
You're not going to know.
Well, today we're talking about election polls.
Yes.
So what's the takeaway?
Well, here's the takeaway. I got interested in what the Pew Foundation has been writing recently. The Pew Foundation is one of the best, most reputable polls, not only in the United States, but in the world. And they do stuff occasionally. About polling methods geared to, like the rest of us, not statistical stuff necessarily. And they've recently been writing about, are polls trustworthy? And they've also been writing about the new sorts of things that you can use maybe to supplement polls. The answer to the first one, are polls trustworthy? They say, yes, they are. And the reason this is an issue right now, of course, is that after 2016, lots of people said the polls were wrong, we'll dismiss them. We'll get back to that in a little while. First of all, though, Pew says the 2016 polls were actually quite good. You don't want to tell that to Hillary Clinton, but they were quite good because nationally they were almost exactly on target in terms of the percentage of the vote, popular vote that they would get.
Right, so off by 1%.
1% off. Where the polls had trouble were statewide polls that ran into two difficulties that are now being overcome, one of which is that they stopped polling too early, probably, because there turns out there was a late surge and the surge was mainly for Trump. And the other thing is that the methods that they used overrepresented people with a higher degree of education, which were then that was a group more likely to vote for Hillary. Okay, those things can be dealt with in a methodological kind of way, and they are being dealt with in a methodological sort of way. So that, and that what the Pew Foundation says is, look, you can trust the polls in regard to those kinds of things, but always keep in mind that there are two kinds of polls. There are polls that are asked to predict the results of a political race. Those are harder to do because you're asking to make predictions down the road. You're judged on the basis of, did you get it right exactly? And there are all kinds of polls that are much more dependable over time and can be measured against real live events. For example, the polls on same-sex marriage clearly showed a very remarkable change in public attitudes toward that, and you could test that alongside of the fact that, in fact, same-sex marriage laws were beginning to change even before that. There's all kinds of benchmarks. So polls are all in all pretty trustworthy. But here's the problem. In the old days, when I learned how to poll, and that's so long ago, we didn't have telephones. We had a yodel. Questions.
Okay.
The main thing was you took a random sample, you asked the questions, you tried to get a high response rate, over 50%, let's say, and that was how it's done. Today you have two problems. One is, and they're related, one is cell phones, which are harder to tap into, and the second is very, very low response rates. So the state of the art has done something that seems to work pretty well. It's come up with ways to predict and to model and to weigh so that you can make the sample you get, you can convert it into a kind of representative sample. It's gone as far as pollsters like YouGov, where you volunteer to participate, no more this random sample stuff. And they've been pretty accurate. They've been about as accurate as any other poll. But the new stuff, which is not so new anymore, but still new, is what we call voter data files, or what you know as big data. And that's the stuff, and then I'll stop here and let you ask me some questions. That's the stuff that Pew is interested in for one reason, and that is, can that give us a fuller picture of what the American voting public is like? Because it approaches things in a very different way. And what, as citizens, we have to understand is just exactly what this is, because it's information about you amalgamated in ways that may surprise you.
Yeah, I know the internet is kind of scary because it can collect all kinds of data on you, and it can, well, as we saw with the headlines with what they were saying Russia was trying to do to influence the elections. And so, yeah, that's something you makes people a little bit nervous, I think.
Well, it does make people a little bit nervous, but remember how this kind of thing works. And first of all, think of a voter file as a file. Think of it as a little manila thing that you used to put your papers in before you mm-hmm. put them on the computer so they could get hacked. And what's in this file initially, thanks to the ease with which you can get this information because Congress passed a federal law, is information on your voting behavior, not whom you voted for, but whether you voted or not. So the file starts off with that kind of information. Are you registered and do you vote? Then through commercial things, you can buy stuff. You can buy commercial firms have ways of modeling using this kind of data and other kind of data that suggest things about partisanship. You're likely to vote for a certain candidate. So your file is getting thicker now. They now have some models that apply to you. Add to that the enormous amount of information that you can get on the web, and that commercial firms will amalgamate on all of your buying preferences. I mean, if you worry about fake news, that's one kind of worry. But the fact is that there's all kinds of information on what you buy and what your preferences are and lots of other stuff. And this all gets lumped together in a big file that sophisticated political campaigns can use to determine how likely you are to vote a certain way and so on, what your preferences are.
Right. I mean, it's all just data mining.
Well, it is. It's called big data for a reason.
But you basically have to then be really careful because, I mean, it's all the stuff you like.
Well, sure. Well, but, you know, being really careful means essentially for most people deciding they're not going to, you know, they're not going to use Amazon anymore. They're not going to use anything where, in fact, these – you know, your preferences get picked up by selling it or whatever else. And that's pretty hard to do. Now, this is really a very useful thing for political campaigns because it tells you much more than a poll, say like the Civil Beat poll that just came out. The poll is a kind of standard poll. It says who's winning and
who's ahead, what the margin is.
Right, yeah. But it's not a very detailed kind of poll. It's certainly like most polls. This tells you much more. What Pew is interested in and what others are, those who are nonpartisan, is to see, okay, we understand that even if polls themselves, the surveys are limited, are trustworthy, they're still limited. It's just a little portrait. And what we would like to see is the extent to which you can use voter files to make the portrait richer, to make it more detailed,
accurate. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So Pew's been doing a few tests on this, and they find out that actually what they've done is they've got a kind of very dependable file of information about stuff, and they've tested some of these big data operations against it in terms of accuracy. It doesn't do badly.
It's really kind of the psychology behind the data mining, which way you're leaning, more to the left or the right.
Well, part of it is if you think about a political campaign and you think about five guys and four women going out after having a cup of coffee at Zippy's and canvassing the neighborhood with nothing else than a list of names, that's enthusiastic but kind of a slipshod way of doing it. If people have information about particular kinds of households and particular kinds of messages that about people's tendencies, not that you know, it allows you to allocate your resources in certain ways. National political campaigns use this kind of information, for example, to try to figure out where they should advertise in certain kinds of ways. So it's pretty useful for that sort of thing. Pew is interested in something that's a little bigger. One of the things that is that Pew sees potential for is the question of voter turnout and who actually votes and who actually does not vote. Voter turnout is the question of who's a likely voter is a very debated one, and that's a very important one in traditional polling because you ask likely voters and you have different ways of measuring it. Turns out that the voter files in 2016 that they tested were very accurate predictors of turnout in 2016. Hmm. What they weren't so good at is getting information on people who don't normally vote or who don't normally register because you start that sort of thing.
Yeah, they're kind of a blank slate.
They're sort of a blank slate or semi-blank slate. You can find out what kind of beer they like, which is they do. There's alcoholic beverage preferences. I suppose if you put all of the above, you go into a certain kind of category.
But basically, you're saying when people volunteer to participate in the YouGov thing, you're taking an action to take part in that. But really, with this voter file, it's like they're just sucking it up. You don't give them permission.
Right.
But
I'm a YouGov volunteer. Most of the time, I don't do the survey. All that means is that they send me something. If I want to fill it out, I fill it out. What they know, what I've told them about myself is fairly limited, but it's enough to get them started in terms of whether they have an accurate sample. They may end up not using me or weighting my thing as much. That's different. The voter file, you're not volunteering right. for other than going out and buying something, you know, where you get the data. And also, it's not the same process.
Right. Okay. So we'll see how accurate Civil Beats polls are this week.
Well, yeah. Good luck. Good luck on all the pollsters in Hawaii.
Absolutely. So. All right. Neil Milner is the Conversation's contributing editor of our regular segment, The Long View. You can find links to more information about today's segment on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Ronan Farrow talks about his Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting on how Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed and assaulted actresses. We'll also talk about attempts to suppress the story by threatening Farrow as well as those actresses. And we'll discuss his new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Aloha, I'm Dina Yoshimi from the Hawaii Roadmap Initiative. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we looked at the nation's smallest and least populated county, Kalawao County on the island of Molokai. Kalawao is located on the isolated Kalaupapa Peninsula on Molokai's north shore. The Kalaupapa colony was created in 1866 as a location where leprosy patients were forcibly exiled. Sufferers of what's now called Hansen's disease were involuntarily sent to Kalaupapa for over 100 years, from 1866 to 1969. The settlement was created by the Hawaii Board of Health under the authority of King Kamehameha V. With the development of antibiotics in the 1940s, isolation of Hansen's patients were no longer required. However, many of Kalaupapa's residents chose to remain in the only home some of them had ever known. Kalawao County became a national historical park dedicated to preserving the story of the people who lived and died there. But the original legal structure of the county remained. It is still administered by the Hawaii State Department of Health. In today's quiz, we asked you who serves as the mayor of Kalawao County, and under state law, it is the director of the health department who holds executive powers within Kalawao County. So he or she can even appoint a county sheriff from among local residents. And we have a winner, Corey Wong of Salt Lake, got that answer. So congratulations to you. And thanks to listener Jerry Garcia from Kona, who submitted today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition. Online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
It's a fitting capstone to Lois Ricciardi's 30-year career as director of the Kauai Chorale. She and her singers, all volunteers, some amateurs, some professional, have been invited to perform on Memorial Day at Lincoln Center in New York City. They'll be performing an especially demanding work, Carl Off's Carmina Burana. As she got her singers ready for the prestigious event, Ricciardi spoke with Chris Vandercook.
What is most challenging is learning to the secular Latin and the medieval German Mm-hmm. It is not church Latin. It is secular Latin, which comes from the poems that they that Karl Orff found from the 1300s and put to music.
Why this piece? You know, why do you think that this is an important piece for to be taking to Lincoln Center?
Distinguished Concert International of New York called and invited us to participate in choruses from all over the world because they had heard our audition and they accepted us. They invited us, actually. I didn't even know that they had heard us and called me when I was about ready to retire from the Koi Chorale and ask if we would come and do this work with them. Mm-hmm. And that is how it got started last September. They are wonderful people. They are people from all over Kauai, and some are professional and some are not. We work together and work really hard, have a lot of fun, and this was the work requested by them. We are also going to be doing something to honor the armed forces, and a special song that I wanted to have as my last hurrah as I leave the directorship of the Koi Chorale.
Well, and you're a non-auditioned chorale, is that right?
That is correct. We are non-auditioned, and it tends to, people seem to weed out themselves if they really don't understand what is required. They have to commit to rehearsals and be there, and the rest takes care of itself as we work hard together.
So you're a volunteer, you love music, you love to sing, and not necessarily a professional. I guess the question is, how do you get them to sound so good to take on a challenging work like this?
Hard work and sweat, but they rise to the occasion. We have lots of rehearsals. We stop and start. We make sure the pronunciation is as close as we can get to what is required mm-hmm. of the German and Latin. And, I mean, that's my background, is to make sure that they get it. I have patience up until a point, yeah, as long yeah. as they do their part, and I do mine.
Well, you know, within this story is, I would think, a good deal of encouragement for people who love music but have sort of thought, well, I'm not a professional, so I should just sort of sing in the shower. This is kind of bringing that out of people, isn't it?
It sure does. And I think one of the treasures that I have gotten over the years is the letters, the phone calls, the little notes, the thank yous of how they never thought they could do it, or it was a healing of somebody passed away that was very close to them, and they came out and sung, and it made them feel so much better, and they just were so encouraged. One man joined the chorale because his mom, who passed away, had the same name, first name as me, Lois.
Uh-huh.
And he felt called, and a wonderful singer, wonderful bass, and been with us ever since.
Do you find that some of the people who come in to be part of the chorale are a lot better than they thought they were, or can be made to be a lot better than they thought they were?
Yes, yes. I believe almost anyone can be taught to sing. Some is a little harder job than others.
Mm-hmm.
They need to learn how to sing with others. But we have very strong singers, so if they are sitting near someone who knows their part, mm-hmm. then it makes it much easier for the weaker ones to catch on. So we seat them so that the strength helps the weaker ones, and it works.
When you get one of the weaker ones who maybe has potential, how do you move them from, you know, toward being able to perform with you? What are their first steps in sort of getting from that space?
First steps would be to encourage them. I do listen to their voice to see if they do have the right section. I also have people within the chorale that help me tell me that this person really shouldn't be a soprano, or this person shouldn't really be an alto.
Mm-hmm.
And then I check further and then help them find the right part, encourage them, and have them sit next to. Sometimes we also use take-home study recordings, mm-hmm. and that helps a lot of people gain the confidence they need.
How many singers are you taking to Lincoln Center?
We are taking 44 of our, we have 80 right now for this season. It goes, it fluctuates each season. It's an expensive trip, so we have 44 singers and 16 guests to go, what we call VIPs. Mm-hmm. So there's over 60 of us actually that are going to be going to Lincoln Center. And it's very exciting. And it's a very exciting way for me to say, that's my last hurrah.
Lois Ricciardi is the outgoing director of the Kauai Chorale, which she's run for three decades. The ensemble performs Carl Off's Carmina Burana on Memorial Day at Lincoln Center in the Big Apple, and you can get details on our Facebook page. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we look at the electricity challenges around Puna. We'll be speaking with Hawaiian Electric Company's Jim Kelly. Tell us what you think or suggest an idea for our show. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. And the show can be found on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz, and we'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.